Hey everyone, I'm Mike. I'm an alcoholic. I have a home group. This is it. I have a sobriety date, October 31st, 2021. It's not my first one, but it is the last one so far. I'm not currently sponsoring anybody, but I do have a sponsor. He knows I'm his sponsee. We do talk regular. And fortunately or unfortunately, I guess I should thank Dale for pulling my name out the nut can this morning and making me hit. You know, there was I was not the first choice, but I was the one that said, okay, I'll do it. So that's what AA has taught me, if nothing else. Whenever I'm called to try to do anything that I can for AA, I do it. So with that said, I was born in 1967 in Charleston, South Carolina. I'm a military brat for 4 years anyway. And the first 4 years of my life, we did a lot of traveling. My dad was in the Air Force. So we were in South Carolina, and then we went to West Virginia while he went overseas, and we went to Nevada, and then we went back to West Virginia while he was overseas, and then we went to Maine, and that was in 1971 to 72, and 1972, May 10th, my mom died. And at that point, my dad put in for retirement and reenlistment at the same time, and retirement came in first. So we packed everything up. My aunt came along. She took me to, me and my brother back to West Virginia early while they wrapped everything up. And once he followed through, we established roots in West Virginia. That's where all the family was originally from. My mom and my dad are both from West Virginia. Somewhere around a year went by, my dad remarried. So I went from, I'm the youngest of three boys, and we went from having three boys to having three boys and a stepsister. So we were a blended family of four, and it was by no means the Brady Bunch. I'm here to tell you, because the problem started right away. And not so much, I ain't gonna say for me, but just in the family in general. And that probably this is, you know, earliest memories is just fussing and fighting amongst ourselves, but that's okay. Outsiders do not bother us. I mean, we could squabble and do anything we could. But drinking was always around when I was coming up. Does that mean that's why I'm an alcoholic? No. But I knew what drinking was at an early age, and probably somewhere around the age of 7 or 8, I was probably tasting beer, not getting drunk, just, you know, family functions and having a taste and not liking it. And that's one of the strange things. There's no drugs in my story. I am purebred alcoholic. So you won't hear me talking about anything about crossing over. I dabbled in something here or there, but it was never nothing. I'm one of those people that my middle brother had a bad experience and I learned from it. And that's goes to show nothing else. I could see the example of what drugs would do for people and leave it alone. Alcohol, on the other hand, we're coming up, and I guess the first real drink I can remember having was when I was 14, and it was my oldest brother's wedding, and it was New Year's Eve, 1980, and he poured champagne for everybody, and he said, "Here, you can have this too." So I had a glass of champagne, and there was no magic moment. There was no warm, fuzzy feeling. There was no, it was just, so what I experienced from these eyes looking out, everything I saw about alcohol, I hated. I hated what it did to my dad. I hated what it did to our family. I hated what I saw in my experiences with alcohol, and I swore I'd never drink. That was what I was talking about growing up, and that's the way I lived, even up through my teenage years. I would dabble here, have a beer there, but I would never try to indulge in going partying or anything like that because I didn't like the way it looked on the outside. So with that said, I came all the way through high school, no problems. I was a very good student. And I learned at an early age, and these are my defects in my story as I'm talking about them. I learned at an early age, my two older brothers, they did partake in drinking and they liked to go out and get into fights and things of this. And I learned if I got good grades and stayed out under the radar, that I could do anything I wanted to do. And pretty much I did growing up. I was always under the radar of my parents. They were chasing my sister and two brothers around. They were getting grounded. They were getting in trouble. People were calling our house, telling on my brothers and sister. And I seen all this, and I learned what not to do as a young kid. And I probably got away with more than any of them ever did in their lifetime just by learning what not to do. So my defects took off at an early age. You know, I was a liar, a cheat, a thief. I was insecure, selfish, self-centered. All those things were brewing in me all the way coming up. I just never added alcohol to them to make them explode. Until I was 17, I graduated high school. The Army recruiter came over to the house. And in West Virginia, if you're not from there, pretty much you got two choices. A, you go to the coal mines, or two, you go to the military when you get up old enough to go. So my choice was the military. So the Army comes over. I'm 17. They sit down at the table. We're going over our options. And the recruiter tells my dad, he's like, "Well, right now we're in bad need of MPs in the military and the Army. And we're willing to give your son a 4-year scholarship at West Virginia University if he'll give 6 years in the Army afterwards." That's a pretty good deal. What do you think? My dad was like, "Yeah, my boy wants to go to college. We'll send him down to West Virginia Tech, and he can do what he wants to do when he's 18. Until then, you can just get on out my house." And there went the Army recruiter, my college scholarship. So, and in those days, I was young enough and disciplined enough that we listened to our parents. What I found out later is that 2 weeks later, we're working, and I mentioned the Air Force, and I said my dad was a 20-year Air Force man. Within a half an hour, I was in the recruiting station for the Air Force getting signed in. My dad wanted somebody to follow his footsteps. So I was it. I was his last chance. As soon as I mentioned it, I was signed in. Now, the backstory to that, somewhere shortly after my mom died when I was 4, up through about 10 or 11, I had two goals. Because growing up, my oldest brother and my dad had their moment where they got kicked out. Well, they got into their little fuss and their fight and their rebellion, and my oldest brother had to leave home, and he was gone about 6 months, broke his leg. By default, he had to come back home, be taken care of. And again, I said my middle brother had a bad experience with the drugs. Somewhere about 16, 17, he had his rebellion with my father. Off he went, and he was gone about 6 or 7 months, 8 months maybe, and he had his bad experience with the drugs. He totally destroyed some people's homes, and he had to come home. He had stitches in both arms. Looked like somebody just cut right up with glass, where he had just walked through all these windows and tore this house up. And so my number one goal was to be the son that didn't get kicked out of the house or leave. So low, 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 low goals in my life. And the second one was, for some reason, I was watching my dad with my middle brother, and I just did not want to be a mooch off my father. And I said, "I will not be in this household after the last Social Security check gets cashed on my 18th birthday." So my last Social Security check for my mother came in on August 1st. I was gone to San Antonio, Texas on August 21st, August 20th. So I achieved those two goals. And my third goal in life was to see Asia. And that's ironically where I got sent to with the military right off the bat. So my life is complete at the age of 18. I have not been kicked out of the house. I have gotten away from my father and everybody, and didn't have to mooch off of him for no money. And I'm in Asia. Life is great. The thing about it is, when I was going into the Air Force the night before I went to San Antonio, Texas, I learned what alcohol really would do for you. And we were all in a motel in Beckley, West Virginia, and we started buying alcohol and having a party. And we were supposed to be up at 5 o'clock. Well, about, I don't know, 5:30 the next morning before I got on the plane, I heard a key hitting the door of my motel room. And I jump up and I meet my recruiter halfway across the door, halfway across the room. And he's like, "Well, they said they gave you a courtesy call 3 times. You never answered the phone, but here you are standing up." When I opened the door, he said, "I just can't believe them lying people would do that to you." I'm escaping already, drinking and escaping. That's great. So I go off to San Antonio, Texas, and I'm down there for basic training. And then we get bussed across to Wichita Falls. That's where I went, Shepherd Air Force Base, is where I did tech school. Well, in Texas, the drinking age was 19. And I'm, like I said, I'm 18. But two things. One, I had a buddy that was 19, so we'd go into clubs and he would buy the alcohol. And two, there was a club right outside the main gate that they didn't care how old you were. If you had $20 to join their club, you could drink all night anyway. So I learned real quick who to hang out with and what to do. And the only way you could have fun in the Air Force in these eyes was to be hanging out with the ones that were drinking. So that's what I started doing. And very quickly, I had no governor. Like Billy, I've heard Billy describe it in the past. I was a throwaway to top drinker. When I started, I did not know how much I was going to drink. And when I was not drinking, we were just talking about having fun again. So that was the way things started off early. Like, it was fun. Don't get me wrong. I was having fun with it at a young age. I was early. My body was tolerating it pretty good. I was getting up, going to work the next morning. No problems. So anyway, we go through Texas and I go to Florida next for school, and we're doing the same thing there. We go to school for 3 or 4 hours, and then we go out in the afternoons and we drink and play pool, whatever we do. Single people making $200 a month with no bills because they gave us our own health insurance. We had our own meal cards. We had everything. We didn't have to pay for anything. So our money was our money to just drink on. And that's what we did. So this takes us up through January. No, this takes us up through February of 1986. And I come home for 30 days leave. And let me back up to 85 when I come home from the Air Force for Christmas of 85. My oldest brother got home. My middle brother got home. I was home. My sister was home. And we were having Christmas. And my dad, at one point during the time we were all there together, he told us, he said, "Boys, y'all might want to enjoy this." He said, "This could be the last time that we're ever together." And never would a truer statement be, and I'll get to that. But anyway, I go off in March of 1986, and I go to the Philippines, three quarters way around the world, 18 years old, never been nowhere in my life. But I'd already started drinking, and we started in San Antonio or San Francisco on a jumbo jet that had three rows, and we were buying from this one, and we got cut off over here, so we were buying from this one, and eventually they found out and cut us off altogether. But we flew into Tokyo, Japan, and I don't remember flying into Tokyo, but I do remember we had a couple hour layover, and I had to get off, and it was like this little round terminal, and we were just walking in circles for like 2 hours, and I bought this Coke while I was over there. And it was in itty bitty spiral cans like you see Red Bull in now. And in 1986, this thing was like a dollar. And I'm like, good gosh, I can't afford to buy a Coke over here, But we fly on into the Philippines and I get settled in. And that's when life really takes off. We fly in, it's a hostile country. Those of us that are old enough, Ferdinand Marcos had fallen out of graces with his people, they were ousting him. The military base was full of all Filipino defectors who didn't want to be killed by the new coup coming in with Aquino. And so Marcos is flying out, Aquino's taking over, and there's a new settling going on in the Philippines where they're beginning to hate Americans very, very quick. So we go down and we get settled in, and I'm an aircraft mechanic by trade. That's what they said. I wasn't bad at it, I will say that. But anyway, the motto around the shop was that we were crew chiefs by day and we were brew chiefs by night. And that's we were all about drinking, and how we didn't kill somebody, I don't know. And any pilot that would trust a crew chief is crazy. Yes, I'm talking to you, Tim. So we're having fun with it. There's no problems, no nothing going on yet. But that's soon to come crashing down because early in 1986, we have to go in on Saturday some days and work on the aircrafts. Two people. One's a shop foreman, and then one airman has to go in. So my Saturday comes up, my weekend comes up. We usually did it on Saturday. But Friday night we go down. I'm hanging out with the boys. We're doing our thing. And I black out. First time I've had a blackout. And I wake up and it's about 12 on Saturday morning. And when I open the door, there's like five post-it notes stuck to my door about, "Where are you? You're supposed to be at work." And I can remember going to work thinking to myself, if there ain't no God and there ain't no afterlife, and I've been lied to my whole life, I probably just experienced what death is going to be like when I die. That was as far as the blackout problem ever worried me. Never gave it a second thought that I was doing anything wrong, never thought about it being abnormal. Just that if this is what death is like without any afterlife, I just died last night. And this is what I got coming in old age when I die. So that was the pattern of my drinking would take. I became a blackout drinker on a most frequent basis. And most of the time on Monday morning, I was the talk of the shop because I was usually doing something I shouldn't have been doing, or I was doing something so stupid that people had to talk about it. And this went on for a while, and I would always get up on Monday mornings later on, after about a year of this, and be praying, "God, please let something have happened even worse than me last this weekend." So they'll be talking about something else. God don't answer prayers like that. I know that today. In 1987, 1988, right at the border of 87, 88, not so much. I come into work one Monday morning and I'm not to talk. And they're talking about this other guy that's worked in the shop. And he was making homemade fireworks downtown, and he was had the pipe in between his legs, and he was tamping black powder, and something happened. It sparked, and it just blew him completely smithereens. And then I'm thinking, oh, Lord, I killed a man. I've been praying to God for something worse to happen, and now it's happened, and now I'm, ooh. So, you know, me and God were not on very good terms. I was like, you know, I didn't want that to happen. So, you know, something, but not that. But it came down early 1988. Well, actually, in 1987, I took my first hostage. I had met this young lady, and we got married. And I thought it was what I wanted. But within 30 days, I found out it ain't what I wanted. And, you know, she probably was a nice girl. I just never gave her a chance. I was full blown into wanting to drink, and it didn't matter what the price was. So I get married. I'm still continuing my single lifestyle, and slowly there ain't no marriage there. It's just more, I've taken her hostage. There ain't no divorce in the Philippines. So she's got to live with what she's got. And she was a sport about it, because what she got out of the deal was a free ticket to the United States, you know. And so this is what life was like for a couple of years of just arguing, fussing, fighting, getting bit, getting stabbed, whatever it was that she was doing to fight back. And I will say, standing here, she was the first and one and only woman I've ever been scared of in my life. We would get into an argument, and I would go in the bedroom with all the sharp instruments, knives, forks, whatever it was, put it up about 6 foot, because she was only 4'11", and then I would lock the door and go to sleep. I was not going to die in my sleep with this woman. And that's, so this was life for about three to four nights out of a 7 day week. I was locking the doors, putting all the sharp instruments up. And, you know, early on we had some good times, and it was the marriage crap, complete washout all the time. That we did have our moments, but it was an alcoholic marriage, and I was not giving her any efforts for it. So, you know, needless to say, it didn't last. It lasted longer than it should have, but the only reason that is again, I say there was no divorce in the Philippines. So once I had her attached, I couldn't get rid of her. I could not shake her. But leaving the Philippines, well, so 88 comes, and problems are starting to happen at work now. I'm not missing work, but just not being able to function. Downtown things are happening. They killed three or four people in the Philippines during the terrorists did. And so they start putting curfews out on the base. First it started at 9 o'clock, and then it got moved back to midnight. But in between times, I got caught twice during curfew. And I didn't think it was such a big deal, but in the airports, it was what they call disobeying a direct general order. It's like Article 92, the highest thing you can get busted with in the Air Force. So they didn't take too kindly to it. The first time they kind of just slapped me on the wrist, gave me a fine, and said, do better. The second time, they reduced my rank. They put me in jail for 30 days of correctional custody, they called it. It was like a rehabilitation. And if you didn't do well in it, then they could get you out and just process you right on out of the military. And during that second curfew violation, they made me go over and speak to somebody about my drinking. Well, just like we heard yesterday, just like any good alcoholic, I'm telling them the truth about my drinking. So I go up and I have this interview with this guy, and he's like, so how much do you drink in a sitting? I said, 4 or 5. Yeah. I was drinking a fifth a night when I was drinking. So, but I'm only drinking 4 or 5 drinks when I go up there. And he just shakes his head, and he's like, well, do you ever drink alone? Well, no, I go downtown and drink. I'm surrounded by people. You know, I was drinking alone at home sometimes. But whatever question he had before him, I was lying about it. And even after lying about it, at the end of this thing, he's like, dude, you got problems. What do you mean? And like the man said yesterday, I was like, hey, give me the paper back. I'll do better next time. You know, whatever it took. So they recommended me to stop drinking and start going to these outpatient treatments that I did not hear. So I go off to correctional custody for the 30 days. And I was good enough to fit in with them that after 15 days, they let me go back to work during the day. And I just had to come back here at night. So they said I was rehabilitatable. So they said they were going to keep me. And I did my 30 days, and on the first night coming out, my buddy picked me up, and he's like, so you want me to take you home? And I was like, nah, you just take me by the liquor store. Everything will be all right. So right back to blackout drinking 30 days after stopping. And that was on a Friday night. Monday morning, I get a call from the base, and the guy's like, yeah, so now that you're out of CC, let's talk about your alcohol program. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Well, don't you remember we had that talk before you went in? And I was like, well, yeah, I kind of do, but I thought that was all about a wayside. And he's like, well, what did you do over the weekend? I said, well, I went out, got to drinking and did it. Man, you ain't supposed to be drinking. So I go back up and I start talking to this guy. And he, at that time, they could order you to go to AA. And that was what I was done. I was told to do. I was ordered to go to AA twice a week and to stop drinking. So anyway, wanting to keep my military career, just stopping drinking wasn't no problem. And trying to find a meeting in the Philippines, you know, there wasn't but like three meetings, I don't think. That's all I could find. But anyway, I walk into my first AA meeting. And the only thing I can tell you that I can remember from that is I walk in, they look at me, we all introduce ourselves, and then this young lady, when it comes top of town, jumps up on a soapbox and she just goes crazy. And then everybody goes around the room talking about you, poor thing. Yeah. And I'm like, if it, this is not for me, this is not for me. So I managed to make it through. That was in April of 1989, and I came home in May of 1989. I made it from early April through to about May 9th, 10th without drinking. So we get on a plane to come home, and I make it all the way to Korea without drinking. So somewhere though, when we got to Korea and we were going to fly to Alaska, coming back to the States, the thought came in that I could drink on this plane. Nobody's going to know it. So once again, I've been to Alaska. I couldn't tell you what it looks like though. I was blacked out coming through Alaska back into San Francisco, and I come out of the blackout in San Francisco, waking up with 10 minutes for a connection flight to LAX. So I got a brand new wife, all this luggage, and all this stuff to get through customs, and we did it. And I was a functioning alcoholic. I ain't gonna deny that I wouldn't. I mean, I never did lay down and just quit. I could keep on moving. And that's one of the things that I hated about alcohol is because it wouldn't knock me out and keep me out. I was just dumb enough to keep getting up the next morning and doing what I had to do. But anyway, so we run into LAX and then we come all the way across to Tampa, Florida. That's where I had orders to. And we settle into Tampa, Florida. And we check in and we go over. And once I get all in processed, all this alcohol stuff comes flying in. And then I have to go meet the counselors here. And by then, I've done come up with some good lines. So I just start feeding them a bunch of stuff. And they're like, yeah, I think they jumped the gun. We're going to make come to one session a week, outpatient. We think that's all you need. And that was good from March, April, no, May through to September. And by September, I was back up full blown again. And my wife and I had a fight. I tried to leave. She didn't want me to leave. It turned into the police at my front door, is what it turned into. And the police are standing there, and she's all shaking. And I'm scratched up on one arm, and they're looking at me going, if we find a bruise on her, we're locking you up. And we're throwing away the key because in Florida, we don't let you out of jail until the case is finished. So the next Monday, I'm sitting in my base commander's office. Because she calls her brother-in-law and her sister from South Carolina. They come down and get involved. Punks. That's what I thought at the time. You know, I mean, this was the kind of stuff that happened. I would do something, nobody would know, and then all of a sudden somebody would tell and I'd get in trouble. So anyway, I'm sitting in my base commander's office and they're having this great debate back and forth. And I'm listening to it. Now, this is my wife and them and the brother-in-law. And somewhere in it, she's talking about how Americans hate Filipinos and da 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 da. And I'm just, and that was what I latched on to. So all of a sudden he looks up at me and asks me what I think. And I'm like, are we talking about hating Filipinos or what? I mean, it wasn't humorous. I got sent to 28-day inpatient treatment. And the last thing he said when he looked at me, he said, you better pass or your career's over. So I'm under the gun again here in 1989. I'm going to rehab. And I get put in a 2-day detox. And then I get flown up to Eglin Air Force Base and I get locked in a nut ward on the 5th floor. And probably for the first time, I felt at home. Don't ask me why, but I did not feel I could put my defenses down. And I was relaxed and I identified with the people there. And I was like, maybe I'm half crazy. Maybe that's the problem. And we would go out and play softball for this week and it'd be the nuts against the drunks. And we did what we had to do. And then one day they opened the side door up and they said, all the drunks go next door. So we went next door and they shut the door and they were like, okay, we're time out. We're going to do rehab. And so for the next 28 days, I'm sitting in an Air Force Base rehab center. And I'm having to keep a journal telling how I felt, why I feel this way, or I think this, and it makes me feel. That was, I think, how I had to do it, but it was every day. And then I had to write my life history, which is basically my story. And so I'm doing all this, and then we start having our little group sessions, and I passed it. I come back to Tampa, and I've got my seal of approval, and I believe the paper said that I was dependent upon alcohol. That was my problem. I was alcohol dependent, and my solution for that was to abstain from drinking. Didn't make no sense to me, but it was enough to keep me in the Air Force, and that's all that really counted because, you know, growing up, I didn't want to go to coal mines, so the military had been my option since I was a kid. And this is October, September, October, November of 2000, 89, I'm sorry. And so back to work I go, and that lasts up for another 6 months. And in January, they took me off papers altogether. They thought I had done well enough that they graduated me from the alcohol program in the military. I passed. So it took me 7 months, 6 months to prove them wrong that I hadn't passed. And in June of 1989, I got a DUI in Florida. And probably one of the strangest DUIs, and I've never heard anybody else to say this, and I don't say this to identify out, but I did in the early beginnings. I was drinking, got to driving around. My uncle was dying. I talked to my dad on the phone. He says, "Don't lie to me. Tell him." I said, "Dad ain't good. He's going to die, da, da, da." And off I go drinking. And then sometime in the middle of the night, I'm almost a half a mile or so from Tampa Stadium, big open parking lot, and I run across the parking piece of concrete in the, and I flatten my tire. So I get out, I've got the hatch up on the car, I'm digging for daggone jack, I'm digging for a tire, and I hear this soft, sweet voice just say, "You don't have to worry about that, honey. I have a ride for you." And I turn around, and it's this very pretty young lady in a mini skirt, and I'm like, "And who would you be?" And she's like, "Well, I'm undercover officer so and so, and I have a ride for you coming." They did stings in Florida with undercover prostitutes. And so off to jail I go. And the only thing I can remember about the police station in Hillsborough County, Florida, two things. One, when we got in there, they put me in this little room with glass and a mic camera, and they had little footsteps on there, and it was 9 or 10 of them, and they said, "Now walk on the steps." And I did that. And they said, "Well, that's very good. Now do it backwards." And I was like, I made like one, I might have made two, I don't know. But I just turned around, put my hands in my pocket, kind of walked back to them, ducked my head. And I said, "You got me. Okay, you got me." And so they take me in to put me in the cell for the night. And it was like an igloo. That was the second thing I can remember about this place. I had to get down on my hands and knees to crawl into where I could get into the cell. And I had my blanket, this, that, the other. I'm hot as all get out. And I'm like, "Why'd they give me a wool blanket? Who wants this blanket?" And like 1,000 voices go, "Ah, dude, I'm in this morning. I should have kept the blanket, but I throw it." And I wake up freezing the next morning. I'm freezing to death. So I should have taken the heat of the morning and keep the blanket dummy. But I'm too embarrassed to call my wife. Don't want her to bail me out. I was part-time working at Domino's Pizza while I was in the military. So when it got time and I knew one of my buddies would be up, I called them and he had to work and he said, "Well, it'd be tonight before I can get you." And I said, "That's fine. I got the money in the bank. I'll pay you as soon as you get here and bomb me." And it's like 12:30. This happens on a Friday night, Saturday night, 12:30 or so. Here I'm getting bonded out. And we're leaving and I show up at the house on early Sunday morning. Been gone almost 2 days, but it's nothing new to my wife. She just kind of looks when I come in the door and nothing's really said about it. Then I found out later that had I just been smart enough or just been humble enough to call the military, I could have got out for paying nothing. It cost me $500 to get out of jail, and I could have done it for free if I'd have been honest with them and told them I was in the military. But that was one of the things I didn't want them to know. So kind of like when they arrested me, I took my driver's license and military ID and kind of lost it in the back seat of, well, actually, I tucked it in my pants. They found it later. But, you know, there again, my schemes did not work. So at this point in time, the military's looking at me and they're like, "Yeah, we just don't think you're fit for us." And so off I go and they start out processing me. And I'm lo and behold, in July 24th of 1990, I'm separated from the Air Force. And now it's just me and my wife. And that goes on for a few months. And I decide I got to come to move north. I ain't staying in Florida no more. But AA didn't appeal to me, and I had to do it my way. So we come up here 3 years later. I got my second hostage, and she was a little tougher than my first one. She didn't tolerate the drinking, and it didn't take long for her to say, you got to make a change. So I come into AA in Virginia. My first meeting was Hebron Valley. And it was Tommy D and some of the old timers down there, Bill J, a lot of them guys. And they're like, why are you here? And I started talking to them. They said, yeah, you belong. Yeah, come on, keep coming back. And back then, that was the motto around here. Don't take a drink, say a little prayer, come to meetings, it'll get better. And so I was off to the races in AA a second time, trying to get the heat off with the wife. So I go to meetings for 3 months. Tommy D becomes my sponsor. He's riding motorcycles. I just had bought a bike. So I joined the Third Tradition Motorcycle Club. Many of you back in the day might remember the Third Tradition, but it was we used to ride around all of Virginia, Maryland, and do different functions. And so Tommy and I rode down to Appomattox, and we did the battlegrounds and some other things. But after about 3.5 months, my second hostage comes home. And after about a month of meetings, she looks at me one day and she's like, if you really think I'm going to sit here while you go to meetings the rest of your life, you're crazy. So I told Tommy I just couldn't be a sponsee no more because that was the only requirement he had was to call him every day and be in a meeting every night. And I was like, well, my wife don't want me coming to meetings no more, so I can't do your sponsee no more. And so from 93 to 97, I don't drink, but I'm not going to the meetings. And I'm going crazier and crazier. And somewhere in 97, we go to a bluegrass festival, and I put it in my head, if you drink, I'm going to drink. Knowing damn well she's going to drink. So I'm back off to the races from 97 to 98. And she finally had enough and we got divorced. So when we were getting divorced, I came back into AA. It was late 98. And I thought I had done everything I was going to do. And I thought I was really done with it. And I pick up my current sponsor and we start going through the steps. And one of the things that we did while we were working is that we started this group. I was part of the original members who started this group, Blue Ridge Speakers. We also started a big book study of Rapidan. I mean, we did a lot of good things. We were traveling. We were together. And I really thought I had this thing on the hook. And there was one other slip in 2002, right after my son was born, was a one-night drunk. And back on the track I came, and we kept on rolling through the middle of the 2000s. And somewhere around 2012, work had gotten overwhelming, and I just slid away from AA again. And I picked the drink up a third time and stayed drinking until October 31st of 21. And needless to say, it didn't get better. It got different. But problems were coming. Trouble was coming. And this, and the ultimate thing with that was two things. In June of 2020, I got demoted from my supervisor's position back to an officer over some alcohol-related incident that happened here in Madison County up in the mountains that involved me wearing a shirt that had the logo for the jail on it, and they frowned on it even though nobody was around. But that was the final thing that they told me, that I was in consuming alcohol in a uniform item, and they didn't like that. So I got demoted. I went back to officer, and I start working through again. I'm still not coming to AA yet. But I rolled around for about a year. And the second thing, it was October 19th, 2021. I got up one morning. It was a good thought to day drink. I leave, mow the grass, do everything I need to do. My son comes home. My wife comes home. I decided I'm going to go camping up in the mountains. But I needed to get some liquor. And I leave the house to go to the liquor store. Don't remember coming back. Do remember kind of going down to McDonald's, get something to eat, going to the mountains. And come home the next morning, and my wife was like, you should have watched your son last night. And I'm like, what are you talking about? He was really concerned that you was going to crash the truck going up to the mountains. So he kind of just, we tagged along and followed all the way around till you got up there to make sure you made it safe. And, you know, for just for a split second, I got that moment that said, you know what, I can't live like this. I already knew I was alcoholic. I knew I was alcoholic in 1989 when they busted me. I've been fighting it for all these years, but just something for a moment just said, you know what? I know where the answer is at, and I got to have some change. I cannot keep the same pattern of life going, or I'm going to keep getting the same results. And I returned to AA and get my sponsor back. We start talking. And then I began to develop that relationship with God that I did have. Let him go. God never turned his back on me. I turned my back on God. I will admit that 100%. And at one point in time in the Philippines in 1987, when things weren't going my way, I shook my fist up in the air and told God he must not exist because he wouldn't give me what I wanted. All kind of crazy stuff. But I will admit, standing here today, I turned my back on God. He didn't turn his back on me. He kept me safe through all the stuff and craziness that I wanted to do. He let me feel all the pain that I wanted to feel. He let me hurt as long as I wanted to hurt. And but he kept me safe. He kept me alive, and I didn't kill nobody in the process. So now here I am with the dilemma of starting these steps all over again and admitting that I am powerless over alcohol. Okay. And life is unmanageable. Yes, I will admit now, 30 years later, life is unmanageable. Didn't need to come to believe. I already knew there was a God that would take care of me if I'd let him. I had to learn that third step, which was to turn my will and my life over because I could do that mostly, but I still wanted to handle the big parts. I still wanted to control how much money I made, how much I was spending, the glamorous things. It didn't work out that way. I got to turn it over, and I got to turn 100% over every day. And then I get to step four, and I'm writing down an inventory, and I'm doing my inventory verbally with my sponsor, and we continue to do that on a weekly basis. If something's bothering me, I come to him, and things bother me, and he normally tells me, selfish and self-centered. It's me. So, step six, I must continue to watch out for those behaviors that are objectionable. And once they do crop up and I do recognize them, I have to ask God to remove them. Now, it doesn't happen like boom, but I have to work, continue to work at it. So my biggest problem is when I put in a pinch and I'm not thinking about it, I will react. I might say something. I might do something that I later have to regret and make an apology for. It's just one of them things that happens for me. But anyway, when I can slow down and do what AA asked me to do, I don't react as quickly. And that's the way I've learned about six and seven today. I will roll into the morning, and this is what my day looks like. I wake up in the morning and I thank God for the day coming up. And then I ask him for guidance and direction throughout my day to help me to be avoiding selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, afraid actions. One of the things I've learned this time that I actually should have probably learned 30 years ago, it's not what I think, it's how I act. And that's what AA has taught me today, is it's not what I think, it's how I act. So when I'm asking God in the morning for help with direction, I'm asking him to help me with my actions, not my work, not my thoughts, because I know he can't control that, but anything's going to pop through. I also ask that he help me to be an example of him. So there, I'm just trying to keep the pound in to remember that it's not my life today. It's God's life. I am working for God, and whatever he wants me to do, that's what I want to do. And I ask him for the courage to do that because left to my own devices, 100,000 things could come down that would be the right thing to do. And I will pull the matrix on it every time and dodge it because, ooh, that might take some effort. Ooh, that might take a little bit of me having to step out and stand on my own and stand up and say, hey, I don't think that's right. We need to do it this way. But I must continue to remember that step three, I turn my will and my life over the power of God. It's not mine no more. I have to do what he asked me to do. And I have to pray for the courage to do it. And then I have to be able to follow through with the actions to do it. And by no means is it a perfect world that I do it every day on every single item of my life. But I do more now than I did before I came in and when I was drinking. And at the end of the day, when I'm reviewing the 11th step through my prayer and meditation, there's less and less that I'm looking at that, yeah, maybe I should have done that different. Most of the things that I look at that I should have done different today do not involve my defects. They involve just a bad decision that was my decision to make. It had nothing to do with, it didn't hurt nobody, it didn't affect nobody, and it didn't have anything to do with me doing this right here. It's just little things like coming in and sitting down and instead of getting up and feeding the dog right away, those kind of things where I do it, but it's like a couple hours. Didn't affect nobody but myself and the dog a little bit. But the little things that mean something, like with my wife, my present wife, who was hostage for a little while. But we started off on the right foot. She got to see me not drinking for 12 years. We started our relationship off on the right foot. And she was tough enough to stick it out when I did go back to drinking. The other two quitters, I don't know what to say about them, but they were great women. It was my fault that the marriage ended. No matter what I think they did wrong, I have to take responsibility that it was my fault. And that keeps me and my side of the street clean on that. So we come on into step 12, and that's what I'm doing here tonight. I'm out here talking to y'all. Hopefully somebody can take something away from this that one day they'll face a decision and they'll be like, I think I'll try it this way and see if it works. That relationship with God is ongoing, and I build on it every day. And going back through the history of that 34 years that I just talked about, I will hit some of the highlights of what God has done for me that I couldn't do for myself. My second wife and I, when we were married, we had a lovely daughter. And when we got separated and we were getting divorced, somewhere about the 2 month mark of our separation, she moved in with another man. And it floored me. And I was just beside myself with it. And there was one night going to AA, coming back from AA. I was doing my evening meditation, and I don't know. I will say what I think it was the voice of God came to me, not out here, in here. And he let me know, hey, this is a charade. You'll just leave things alone and trust me, you will see that everything's gonna be all right. And I put my faith in God that night about my daughter, that everything would be okay no matter what. And she was 4 years old, 3 years old, getting ready to turn four then. And at the age of 15, we go up through. I give it to God. Things come up in her lives. She's a sickly child, but she comes up into her teenage years. And about the age of 15, she decides that she wants to come live with me. So I get custody of my child because I left it alone. She goes back to her mom's her senior year. And she gets ready to go to college. Very bright kid, but she starts falling with the same stuff my brother was falling with. She gets heavy into drugs and drinking. Loves the party life. Loves this. Once again, I got to let it go. God's going to take care of it. 3 years of Radford. She tried her best to beat them, out drink them, out drug them, whatever it was. I get a phone call one morning. She's in a coma in a hospital in Radford. So off to the races, I'm gone. And we get down to Radford, and they're talking in the hospital, and they say, yeah, we hit her with Halidol to calm her down, and all she did was jumped up, threw her clothes off, and ran down the hall. That's her daddy's girl right there. That's my first thought. That's her daddy's girl right there. Inside, I'm going, oh. And they tell us, they said, we don't know if it's a manic break or whether it's something that got induced with the drugs, and we won't know until she wakes up, because when she wakes up, she's either going to be okay or she's going to be a vegetable. So that's what I'm faced with. Turn it over to God. She woke up fine. So that's what God has done for me. We roll out of that hospital after about 4 days. She comes home, regroups, and transfers into JMU. And I'm happy to say she has a master's degree in education. She's been teaching school for 3 years now, and she's about to make me her grandfather.
All right.
I have a son. That son I told you about has no inklings about wanting to party. Now, my drinking through the years that he would have been, maybe my bad example helped him. But he drinks once in a while. But for the most part, he is the driver everywhere they go. Anytime, anywhere, somebody needs a ride, my son is there for them. And I'd scared the hell out of him. I ain't not going to deny it. I drank and drove with him in my car. And not proud of it, but it happened. But through all of that, like I said, he's 21 years old, getting ready to be 22. He's working out here at Madwood. He's been there 3 years. He's a supervisor, working his way up through the company, very on the fast track. Nothing I did. That's all God. When I stay out of things happen very greatly. When I begin to put my fingers into things, that's when things start falling apart. My wife and I, we probably have better relationship right now than we did 24 years ago. We just celebrated 24 years. She stuck with me through the hard times. She wouldn't give up. I had her to the point of submission. And right before I came back to AA, we were sitting there and she said, "You know what? I think I've had enough. I'm just," and I was going to move to the mountains into my little one room cabin, no running water, no electricity. And she was going to keep the big house because it was hers. And she decided about a week into this whole thing that she really didn't want to give up either. So we have worked, been able to work everything that we had problem-wise out, and probably got a better relationship now than we have had. And we're empty nesters, but we're not empty nesters. My son hasn't left home yet. I keep threatening to kick him out, but he just, she keeps telling me he's staying. So as long as that's fine, he is a good kid. And I probably wouldn't know what to do if he did leave. I do need him around some every now and then. You know, I'm still a little bit bullheaded to the point that I don't want no help, but my body's telling me some days that I gotta have help, and he's good to have around when I do need the help. We go to church on Sunday, and I'm going to end with this. A friend of ours about 2 3 months ago was talking, and this whole spiritual thing that we live by here, it hit me home when he brought and said this. He brought these little guys here in. I don't know if y'all noticed this little guy when I started speaking or not, but we were in church one morning, and he said, "You know, everybody talks about this, and everybody talks, but everybody's always talking about needing a little Jesus." He said, "You need a little Jesus?" And he put a bunch of these out. He said, "There you go. Take your little Jesus, but you can go out of here." So I have brought a little Jesus for everybody to wash it. After the meeting, if you'd like to take a little Jesus with you out of here so you can have it in your pocket to remind you that you did turn your will and your life over to care of God on step three, you can have it. If not, I'll take them back. We'll use them somewhere else. Thank you for having me out, Dale. Thanks for the pulling me out the nut can and making me get up here. Thank you, Taylor, for not being able to do it.
All right.
Turn it over.